This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
God help us.
Holy f***. Holy f***. Holy f***.
It's hard to adequately describe the intense heat, the hurricane-force winds, the hellish fire that destroyed 1,000 homes and other buildings in Colorado on December 30th. It's hard to understand how fast the fire moved, how large it grew, and how close people came to losing their lives. Until you hear moments like this. Families in a Louisville, Colorado restaurant enjoying a meal 1 minute, then the next minute looking through the windows and seeing a wall of fire coming at them and then trying to push open the restaurant doors to escape.
I think it's the wind pushing against the door, possibly.
Go. Unbelievable!
Well, Cynthia Wallace was at home in Louisville that day, too.
I looked out the window and I was like, hey, there's an orange cloud out there. And my husband said, yeah, you know, there's a big dust cloud because it was a windy day. And then we got a text from one of our neighbors saying, hey, there's a brush fire across the highway, just letting you know. And we're like, okay, well, you know, we're in a suburban neighborhood. They're going to go take care of that and put it out, and no big deal. And then the smoke just started getting worse. And around 1 o'clock, my husband was in the backyard just trying to water down our fence in case, you know, some sparks came our way. And he ran inside and said, there's a fire in the yard behind us. Texted my mom and my sister, and I said, I'm 90% sure my house is burning down today. And then we went to a hotel where some of our other neighbors had reserved a room just to wait to see what we were going to do. And we turned on the news, and already all the news coverage was of our neighborhood in flames.
Now that we're showing you this, this is McCaslin in Washington, over in Louisville earlier.
We could see the houses, and we knew who they were, and it wasn't just kind of on fire. It was raging.
He tells me, when I asked, was that one house or multiple, he said dozens and dozens and dozens of homes he saw engulfed in flames from the video you're looking at. It is truly hard to watch. And to give you an idea of where that's at.
One of our neighbors has a first responder for a son, and he let us all know that our houses were gone that evening. For the kids, our youngest is 3, and she doesn't have the vocabulary to really understand. She asks a lot of questions about, are we going back to the house? Where are my stuffies? A lot of questions about, is the hotel going to burn down? Why is there a fire sprinkler on the ceiling of the hotel room? Is that because this place? I mean, you get this repetitive questions because she's trying to figure out, is any place going to burn down?
Cynthia Wallace, a resident of Louisville, Colorado. Is any place going to burn down? That is the question across much of the western United States now, isn't it? Because wildfires aren't just in the wilderness anymore. They're not restricted to that suburban wildland interface either. Fire is a part of the new reality in suburbs and cities in the West. And that truth is unlikely to change anytime soon. So what do those suburbs and cities need to do in order to become more fire resilient or even fire resistant? What permanent changes do people need to make in order to live with wildfire? That's what we're going to look at today. And joining us to help us do that is Natasha Stavros. She has a doctorate in fire science and climate change and is the director of Earth Lab Analytics Hub at the University of Colorado Boulder, and that's at the Cooperative Institute for Research in Environmental Studies. And she joins us from Boulder. Natasha, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So first of all, I am so sorry about what has happened in Colorado. It's the most destructive fire in the state's history. Is that right?
At least in recent history that we have a recorded history of. Yes, that's true.
Okay. And I should just ask just to make sure, did your home survive? I don't know if you live near where the Marshall Fire burned.
Yeah, we were really fortunate. We're at the north edge of Boulder, so we're about 6 miles from the fire. So we were safe because the fire was moving east as opposed to north. So we were kind of just watching all of it unfold.
Okay. You were watching it all. So could you actually see it from where you were on December 30th?
We could see the plume coming. So from our house, I could look out. I looked southeast out the window and I could see the plume. And, you know, being a fire scientist, I was on Twitter and I am plugged into the fire community across the West and particularly in Boulder and in the broader Colorado area. And so I was seeing all of the tweets in real time, and multiple members in that community actually did evacuate, and some of them even lost their homes. So I was seeing the real time updates from a fire science perspective as well as just from the broader community's response and reaction.
Okay. So we're going to talk about the causes of the Marshall Fire in particular in a second. But from a fire science perspective, that's a really, I mean, that's why we're having you on today, because it's quite a unique perspective. In the first, you know, hours and let's say day, what were you learning and seeing from that perspective?
Well, what was interesting about this particular event is that it happened in December, which is pretty unusual, really unexpected. This particular neighborhood is what it's considered low to moderate fire risk. So for there to be a fire there like this is a complete surprise, let alone in December. And so there's that. And then on top of it, just knowing what you know about how fire spreads, specifically with wind events, and the communities that are directly in the line of fire, you know, that's kind of what you're watching and you're seeing, like, okay, the only line of defense here is evacuation.
Oh, okay. So that's a critical thing to keep in mind here. Let's talk about the specifics, though, around this fire. I'm not seeing yet, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't see any sort of official conclusion as of yet about how the fire originated. Is that right?
Yeah, that's my understanding, is that the ignition is still under investigation. Specifically, though, with any fire on the landscape, there's three ingredients, and only one of those is ignition. And so the other two ingredients are fuels and weather. And so we really had the fuels and we had the weather. And the reality is that an ignition is inevitable anytime you have humans interacting with the landscape. There are literally dozens of ways for there to be a spark. It can be any kind of spark. And if you just have the right conditions, it can blow up into a large fire event.
I should say that there are reports, the Denver Post, for example, is talking about how authorities may be looking at land where owned by a religious cult, actually, the 12 Tribes religious cult, because there's some Twitter video of a shed or a barn that was burning there just before the fire sort of exploded over that larger area of land in Colorado. But again, no official word yet about the ignition. So let's talk more about the fuel. What was the fuel that was driving the fast spread of the fire?
Well, so there, in this particular situation, there were two types of fuel, and the initial fuel was grasslands, and the second type of fuel are homes. And so these two burn very differently, and the fire responds differently to these different fuels and actually needs different kinds of conditions for fire to spread across the landscape. So in this particular situation for Marshall Fire, I would argue that the story actually begins in February of 2021, when we saw more snow than we would typically expect for a year. And that snow acts as a water tank, and it stores water on the landscape as a reserve. And this is really important, especially for our grasslands. And then in spring, in about May, we saw more rain than we would typically expect. And that's right at the initiation of the growing season. And so that really sets all of the grasses up to be really prolific throughout the year. And then in July, which is peak growing season, we had, again, more rain than expected. And so right when you would expect your grasslands to start drying out, we received a lot of rain. And so the grasses really continued to grow throughout the year. And then come fall, we saw a massive rain and snow deficit. And so this is what really dries out the fuels. And so one, you've grown the fuels in the grasslands. And then two, you dry them out. And then on that particular day, we had wind. And wind is, it can directly propel a fire forward. It can push the fire, kind of like momentum. But it can also bring with it embers, or what we would call firebrands. And these are little sparks, just like if you've ever had a bonfire or a campfire and little sparks go flying, right? These can get carried actually miles ahead of the flaming front and start new fire. And so these are particularly troublesome in urban environments where there's houses, because all it takes is a little crack in someone's home or under a porch and a little bit of kindling, and that house can then be on fire.
Wow. Okay. Natasha, if you hang on here for just a second, we have to take a quick break. There's so much more we want to learn from you when we come back. We are talking this hour about whether suburbs and cities, urban areas in the Western United States, need to do a lot more to become fire resilient in what seems to be now the year-round wildfire season in the United States. So we'll have more when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we are talking about the lessons learned from the devastating Marshall Fire that happened on December 30th in Colorado, the state's most destructive wildfire in modern memory. More than 1,000 homes and other structures burnt to the ground in a matter of hours. So the big question here is, are the suburbs and cities of the West ready for what now feels like a perpetual fire season? What needs to be done to make those cities and suburbs fire resilient? I'm joined today by Natasha Stavros. She is director of the Earth Lab Analytics Hub at the University of Colorado Boulder, has a doctorate in fire science and climate change, and she joins us from Boulder, Colorado. And Natasha, hang on here for just a second, because let's listen to how the Marshall Fire was experienced by another Colorado resident. This is Steve Sarin. He lives in Superior, Colorado. And on December 30th, he was driving back home from a work assignment in Fort Collins.
My phone started blowing up with text messages from my apartment complex saying that we were under stage one evacuation warning, and local news app notifications that there was a wildfire a few miles from my house and that the 115 plus mile an hour wind gusts were driving it across the plains really, really quickly. We have lots of wildfires in Colorado, but where Superior is, we were under the false assumption that we're relatively protected. The mountains are about 8 to 10 miles away from us, where the majority of wildfires take place. They would have to cross 8 miles of grassy plains to get to us. It's just not something we regularly think of as a danger to our homes and our lives. I pulled into the apartment complex, and there were about 30 of my neighbors standing outside, just watching it come over the ridge that you can see from here. And the fire was blowing insanely fast. You could see it going, we were guessing 20 to 30 feet a second because of the wind. It was just flying. Assuming the giant explosions I just saw were the gas station across the street exploding. After about 20 minutes of just watching the neighborhood burn, the winds changed a little bit. The smoke was right in our faces and it jumped the road. We could see that it was in the neighborhood next to ours, probably about half a mile away, and just going house to house. We couldn't see the houses, but we could see the smoke coming closer and closer and closer. It was at that point that I realized that we weren't watching a wildfire anymore, that we were part of this situation.
This is unreal. It is real close. It's less than 1,000 feet from my apartment building.
I don't think cities out west are prepared for the dangers of wildfires, if they can come at any time within a matter of an hour. I think we do a decent job out here in Colorado of preparing for wildfires that happen in the mountains. I've been out here in this area for 8 years, and the only time I ever thought that there might be a wildfire that affected me was 48 hours before this. I was driving up McCaslin Boulevard, right near the Target and Costco that were destroyed. And I looked out at the grass over the plains and I thought, geez, that is really dry. I don't know if I've ever seen it that dry. If someone driving up this road flicks a cigarette, these neighborhoods are gonna be gone. And 48 hours later, I came to eat those words. It wasn't a cigarette, but it was just, I remember thinking, I just said that this could happen.
Steve Sarin lives in Superior, Colorado. Now, Natasha Stavros, let me turn back to you, because Steve describes living through the outcome of the story that you said before the break begins in February of 2021, that like lots of snow led to, you know, really healthy growth in grasslands. And then if I heard you correctly, there was an unusually dry fall, which allowed that extra fuel to really dry out. And then we had those very high winds. You know, taking the long view here, is that pattern, that weather pattern and that fuel and growth pattern linked? Is it climate linked, Natasha?
It definitely is. It's really hard to say that there's some uncertainty when we try to predict, you know, rain and snow and wind out into the future. But where we have actually a lot of confidence is in rising temperatures. And we know that rising temperatures have an effect on moisture. So the warmer the air is, the more moisture it can hold in the form of rain, not snow. And so we know that as the climate warms, we're actually changing how, when, and where we distribute water across the landscape. And this can actually stress ecosystems that were there before, always had water supply, but maybe aren't getting the same kind of water that they had historically. And so what we're going to see out into the future is we're going to see increased conditions that are ripe for carrying fires like this. And actually my work in 2014 was projecting really large fire events. So this is a little bit different than the Marshall Fire, which was 6,000 acres. I was projecting fires that were on the order of 50,000 acres under climate change. And we actually see out to 2050, a 300 to 600% increase in the likelihood or the chance of fire events like that. And part of that has to do with just a longer fire season. Mm-hmm. Longer, you know, when I say longer fire season, I mean a season under which the conditions are more ripe to carry fire. In December at this time of year, we would have expected to see, you know, 4.5 to 5 feet of snow, which would have obviously prevented a fire from growing in the first place. So that's what we mean is as the climate warms, we're extending the conditions and the time frame under which we could expect to see a fire like this.
Okay, so Natasha Stavros, hang on here for just a second, because I want to bring Erica Fisher into the conversation now. She's an assistant professor of civil and construction engineering at Oregon State University and joins us from Eugene, Oregon today. Professor Fisher, welcome to you.
Hi, Meghna. It's very nice to be here.
So just to sort of draw a line under the fact that these are not isolated events anymore, I just want to remind folks that it was in, what, September of 2020 that the state of Oregon, the western part of the state, experienced some of its worst fires ever. I'm seeing that, you know, more than 4,000 homes and structures burned during those terrible fires that went seemingly up and down the western part of Oregon. That, too, fueled by, you know, lots of dry fuel, extended drought and high wind. So was it any different than what Colorado experienced with the Marshall Fire at the end of December?
The climate is a bit different, as well as the landscape is actually quite different than what the Marshall Fire was. But again, I think what we're dealing with are two regions of the country that do not have any mandated or incentivized mitigation for residents in that area. So that is where there's just a lot of parallels.
Okay. So is it, you know, I'm operating through this hour with the presumption, and check me on it, that it seems that with every passing year, there's that, you know, that wildfire suburban interface that people might be familiar with. But like that interface seems to be shifting into more and more populated areas. I mean, should we even be calling them quote unquote wildfires anymore?
You're asking a really great question. It comes up actually quite a lot in the work that I do, is if we can call these, you know, wildfires anymore. I think really where this shift is coming from is it goes back quite a long ways to how we were actually fighting fires in the 20th century, in the beginning of the 20th century. We used to just put out every single fire. And what that did is it allowed people to think that it was safe to live in these high-risk areas. So we have more people moving into these high-risk areas. It wasn't until, you know, the mid to the late 20th century that we found that actually fire was beneficial to the landscape, and it's a natural occurrence, and we need to allow it to happen so our landscapes can thrive and our animals can thrive within that landscape. And so we had this now shift of we can't put out every single fire because we want the fire to occur, but now we have all these people living in these high-risk areas. And we have more people moving into these high-risk areas. And we even saw it during 2020 and 2021, during COVID, a lot of people moving out of cities into these more remote regions. And so we have, you know, right now, you know, about a third of the people in the contiguous United States live in a wildland-urban interface community. So I think what we have to do now is we have to realize that, you know, just as Natasha said so eloquently, that we can understand the science behind this, and we understand how to predict rising temperatures. You know, the science can tell us what's going to happen. Now it's up to us to be able to be prepared to respond to it and be prepared to mitigate against the drastic effects that we saw in Oregon and in Colorado.
Right. So, and also obviously many other states in the West. I'm thinking about the Paradise Fire in California, right? But, but let me ask you: It seems safe to say that the high risk areas themselves, in terms of acreage, are growing. First of all, and second of all, you know, we keep talking about it sounds like these are rural areas anymore, but these are rural areas, but a suburb of Boulder and Denver, Colorado doesn't sound very rural to me, right, Erica Fisher?
Yeah, it doesn't have to be rural, okay. Right? You know, you have these high densities of houses, and Natasha pointed out, you know, we have these two types of fuels here. So we have our vegetative and wildland fuels, and in the Marshall Fire, that was the grasslands. But in the community, that's not the fuel in the community. The grass is not the fuel in the community. It's our homes.
Yeah.
So when you have a high density of homes just neighboring these very dry and combustible vegetative fuels, this is your situation.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a few papers that just came out that really highlighted that, you know, if you have a high density of damaged homes, you're more prone to have more damaged homes. So, you know, the more homes that combust, the higher the likelihood that additional homes are going to combust. So, we have to, realize that these regions of the country are growing, they're becoming more populated, and that in the community itself, it's really not the vegetative fuels that are fueling the fire. It's our homes itself.
Natasha Stavros, do you want to add to that?
I do. So I think that the important thing is that how fire burns in these two different types of fuel is extremely different. So typically with, vegetation, you would see, direct flames would go from place A to place B, and it's kind of this linear progression. And of course, you have embers that will spark and ignite what we would call spot fires in different locations. That definitely happens in vegetation. But in urban environments, the embers are particularly problematic. And the embers are really what propel fire forward, because these little embers can get sucked into houses. So let's say there's little cracks in your house somewhere from a vent system or something like that. Like, it can be a millimeter. An ember can go, because it's hot outside, to cool in your house, they get sucked into the house and they'll burn houses from the inside out. And this is also true if you have, let's say, wooden structures next to your house. We heard this earlier from one of the residents, the wooden fence next to the house, mm-hmm. or a wooden porch, any wooden furniture you have, even if you have a non-wooden structure next to your house, but you have wooden furniture outside of your house. These all become fuel that these embers can then spark. And then once they ignite, they create a lot of heat. And that heat just is way higher than what we would have expected from the grasslands. And that's why you have this sort of domino effect where you have one house burn and then the next house burn and then the next house burn. And it's all coming from the heat from the house next to it.
So my pause there, Natasha, is actually because I'm trying to – it's heartbreaking. I grew up in Oregon, as everyone who listens to this show knows. My parents still live in the Willamette Valley, and just like every structure in their neighborhood, houses, sheds, et cetera, it's all made of wood. I mean, that's like one of the defining features of growing up in the West, whereas here I'm, in Boston, like everything's made out of brick. I just like imagining that, like you're talking about a system, a physical fabric now that's because of additional population growth there, it seems like it's just really primed for fire now.
Yeah, and I'll let Emily chime in here too, but there is a lot that we can do to make our communities more resilient. What we say here at Earth Lab is, we've got four resilience pathways. And one of them is to build better, mm-hmm. right? So having housing codes for what we would call home hardening. So this is putting ember guards on gutters. This is allowing people to retrofit or, removing wooden structures juxtaposed next to a house to be further away, creating defensible space. And there's a lot of things you can do in the sort of building better.
Yeah.
And, having stucco on the side of your wooden house, right, is, for example, something that can really help so that it's not direct wood exposure.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me just jump in here because we're running headlong into the break, Natasha. Erica Fisher, let me turn back to you. We're going to spend the last part of the the show really talking in much more detail about actual mitigation that can be done. But both of you have said something which I actually find kind of jaw-dropping, that right now, writ large across the West, there's no real required fire mitigation. I mean, Natasha put it this way, that the only mitigation in residential areas is evacuation. I mean, Erica, what do you think about that?
There is mitigation that is mandated in the West. So California actually has some of the strictest residential wildfire codes in the entire world. So there, all across California, there are required mitigation measures, and they've been shown to actually work. There are certain counties in Colorado that have adopted the International Wildland Urban Interface Code and mandate mitigation. And the state of Oregon is about to implement that themselves. So I think it's starting to happen, uh-huh. And it's not as quick as we just might hope.
Okay, so Erica Fisher at Oregon State University and Natasha Stavros at the University of Colorado. Hang on for a second. We'll learn a lot more about specifically what those mitigation efforts are when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tomorrow, we're going to be talking about the Omicron variant, and we want to hear from you. Are cases surging where you are, or have pandemic mitigation efforts worked? You know, is your town or city changing the rules about who can go where? Are you changing your own behavior? And what are your questions about the Omicron variant surge? Call us at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. That's for tomorrow's show. Today, we are talking about whether Western cities are as fire resilient as they need to be in what feels now like a year-round fire season in the American West, and what needs to be done in order to make suburbs and urban areas as resilient to fire as possible. And of course, these questions made urgent once again by the terrible Marshall Fire that burnt down more than 1,000 homes and structures in Colorado in a matter of hours on December 30th. I'm joined today by Natasha Stavros. She's with us from Boulder. She's director of the Earth Lab Analytics Hub at the University of Colorado Boulder. And Erica Fisher joins us as well. She's in Eugene, Oregon, and she's an assistant professor of civil and construction engineering at Oregon State University. Erica, I'm not going to ask why you're in Eugene and not Corvallis. Put that to the side for a moment, but let's listen to how firefighters are talking about changes that need to be made based on what they saw in Colorado. This is Patrick Kramer. He's a firefighter engineer in Longmont, Colorado. And on December 30th, he was off duty eating lunch with his daughter when he noticed a plume of smoke on the skyline. So he quickly joined his crew and they raced to fight the fire in Louisville, Colorado.
As we drove into town, we heard across the radio that there was one of the hotels that's in Louisville was on fire. And it was kind of about that time that I thought, wow, this is really on a bigger scale than I even imagined it could be.
Patrick's been fighting fires for almost 20 years, both wildland and structural fires. But when a wildland fire becomes structural the way it did with the Marshall Fire, Patrick says he's never experienced anything like it.
I've probably never felt as helpless in my life in my career. I've been doing this 19 years, and it's probably the most helpless I've felt. We would pull up to homes that were not burning, and we would start to try to mitigate around them. We would try to put out the little fire we could see. And then within minutes, literally minutes, that house would be fully, fully engulfed. So we would move on to the next house, trying to keep the fire from that house, moving on to the next house. And sometimes within minutes, that next house would be on fire. It was the domino effect. And it was just from someone, when you train to save lives and to save property, and that's what you do, that's what's in your DNA, to put fire out and you can't, and you just watch it take over and just eat away at the neighborhood. It's really, really, it was saddening.
Saddening. And as you heard Patrick describe, much harder to fight. Well, Dave Beebe is chief of the Mountain View Fire District, which covers 10 stations in Boulder and nearby towns, including Superior, which suffered so much damage on December 30th.
Some of the biggest challenges we have now as these wildfires come into urban areas is evacuation is more complicated. There's a lot more people. The fuel model is completely different as the fire starts consuming structures and things that have synthetic and hydrocarbon-based materials in them. They tend to burn a lot hotter.
Right now, crews tend to focus on either structural fires or wildfires. But Chief Beebe says that as the threat of urban wildfire grows, firefighters are going to have to be trained in a new specialty.
There's kind of a blending of the skill sets of the firefighters. A majority of, say, the Forest Service employees who fight wildland fires, that's what they do. They're not skilled or trained in dealing with structure fires. They don't have the equipment. They don't necessarily have the training. And conversely, there are structural fire departments that don't have the training in wildland tactics. They may not have the equipment to do wildland, and yet we are getting a blending of the two types of fires and types of firefighting. And that's, you know, something we have to learn how to apply the tactic sets and the skill sets from both of those different type of environments together to fight a fire in a, you know, wildland urban interface type of environment.
Chief Beebe told us he also thinks what's considered a normal response needs to change. For example, a normal grass fire might usually get one or two engines called to it, but he thinks that number should double when there's a threat of especially dry or windy weather.
The fires are burning hotter. The climate is drier. The temperatures are higher. Unfortunately, this is going to continue. And, you know, as a fire service, and as we always have, we need to adapt and, you know, modify and change things and be prepared to deal with what I see as an escalating problem.
And one more thought from firefighter Patrick Kramer, who thinks that adaptation and change is inevitable across the entire physical fabric of the West's cities and suburbs.
I mean, unfortunately, it happened, but fortunately, we're going to see some information come out of this fire that's going to help people across the nation. I think it's going to help not only builders, developers, homeowners, prepare communities, prepare developments to try to maybe mitigate this in the future.
That's Patrick Kramer, a firefighter engineer with the city of Longmont. And you also heard Dave Beebe, chief of the Mountain View Fire District in Colorado. Erica Fisher, let's start at the level of individual homes. Natasha started talking about this a couple of minutes ago, but what can be done right now to existing homes in the West to make them more fire resilient?
Yeah, I'm so glad that you featured these firefighters. They have such great insight into these communities. There's a lot of voluntary mitigation efforts occurring throughout the West. And what we've seen over and over again, not just with wildfires, but other hazards too, I work a lot with earthquakes as well, is that without a mandatory or an incentivized retrofit ordinance, there really isn't that movement towards actually implementing it. So what we've seen can work actually really well. Are these incentivizations or ordinances throughout the West? And we've seen it, in earthquakes. I think we have to learn from our previous hazards that we've tried to tackle. In the mid-1990s, California adopted a few policies and building ordinances that required roof retrofits. So if you are replacing the roof on your house or you're fixing the roof on your house and you are replacing more than 50% of it, you have to upgrade it to be consistent for wildfire mitigation. So these types of triggers really allow us to incentivize these retrofits, to force them. But what needs to be coupled with this, obviously, is keeping in mind our socially vulnerable communities, those that need some assistance in retrofitting, but also in clearing the land and having that defensible space. So not just monetary assistance, sometimes we need just more, physical assistance to do that so that our elderly and disabled populations can also mitigate.
Okay. Now, Natasha Stavros, are there other things at the level of individual homes that can be done that homeowners should be incentivized to do? Erica talked about roofs, but you had also mentioned that, tiny embers can get sucked into homes relatively quickly. Are there other parts of a home that owners should be looking at to make them more fireproof, essentially?
Yeah, I think the one that I hear the most is ember guards. Mm-hmm. And as Erica mentioned, California has set a really good precedent. Australia has also set a really good precedent for building codes for fire safety, especially in grassland areas like what we saw with Marshall Fire. The problem is that, I've been trying to harden my home here in Boulder, Colorado, and I'm finding it very hard to get access to some of the things that I need. I am informed. And I have a means to be able to get it, and I'm still struggling. And so I think that that's really a message to take home is that, what do we do about the people who aren't informed? And that's where the incentives from the county level, with the codes and, updating and retrofitting, but also providing incentives for people, because it can be quite expensive to do some of these changes. So I think in the individual homes, that's really where we need to sit.
Well, Natasha, why are you having difficulty? Why do you think that is?
Right now I've been looking for ember guards to put on my gutters, and all of the websites I can find are orders from Australia. Oh. I can't find anything in the United States. I also was looking for a company to come out and do a consultation and just look at the property and say, hey, here's what you could do to reduce fire, and there's not that resource is just not available. And so it puts a lot of burden. Fortunately I am in this line of work and I know what to look for, but there's just so many people out there who wouldn't even know the first place to start.
It sounds like there's a gap in the market. Okay. Look, this is clearly a problem that's not going away and people need help as both of you are saying. So let's find ways to give that help. Erica Fisher, I want to zoom out a little bit more from the level of individual homes to, you talked about this earlier, development, right? Because a lot of these particularly fire, these high-risk areas are in suburban developments where, the homes are built right up to the mm-hmm. what is it, the 6-foot limit between property lines here. Should there be changes in zoning regulations for new construction in the West?
Well, I think we have to go back to, how fire spreads from structure to structure, as Natasha summarized earlier. So you can have direct flame contact. So if you have a bush or some sort of vegetation that's on fire, it's directly touching your home. Or if your home is very, very close, like you're saying, 6-foot distance away from another home. So the flames are literally jumping from one entity to the next. So that's one method of flame spread. The next is this radiative heat transfer. So when Natasha was talking about, embers get inside the homes burn from the inside out. There's a lot of heat that is radiated outwards. Radiative heat transfer is one method of heat transfer. And that can be an option of how fire can spread throughout a community and that's not direct flame contact. So you're just heating up the next entity, either, the next home. And so that's how, they can spread. Or embers, as this kind of dominated the conversation today. Embers are actually the number one way that Arthur communities are catching on fire. We don't really see a lot of this direct flame contact as for structure ignition, starting. And that direct flame contact is really more of these urban environments, less of this suburban environments. So it really comes down to making sure that the next entity does not combust. Yeah. So, how do we do that? It's that non-combustible siding. A stucco is a great example, as Natasha pointed out earlier. Our windows, right? We want to prevent fire getting inside of the house and burning from the inside out. Once the fire's inside, you're going to have smoke damage, which is just impossible to get rid of. The fire's just going to spread all over. Mm. So making sure your windows are adhering to the International Wildland Urban Interface Code. Those vents, the roofing.
Yeah.
So it's all about, the materials. But, we know all of this. I don't want to seem all doom and gloom, because I do want to, show a positive light. We know all of this. There's a ton of research that occurred in the late 1990s and the early 2000s. We are still doing research, so we're still trying to understand it a little bit further. But from a baseline understanding of what needs to occur, we have a really good handle on what has to happen.
Okay, so Erica, hang on here for just a second, because we've only got about 2 minutes left here, and there's two other areas that I want to very quickly explore about how to apply that knowledge that you're talking about that we already have. Natasha, I mean, again, with the issue of development, I mean, I imagine that, I don't know, insurers could play a role here. Should they be requiring more of developers when they develop in fire-prone lands?
So I have a lot to say about this topic, and I'll
sadly we don't have a ton of time though.
So there's a couple things that we can do. So there's certainly zoning, and the insurance agency can play a role in incentivizing or disincentivizing developers to develop in certain areas that are high risk. There's another thing that we can think about, which is that when we expand or develop, we bring with us power and energy. And so the role that power companies are playing and what they can do, because, half of the major fires that have happened in the 21st century, the most devastating fires in California history, have been started by power lines and electrical. And so we have to think about how are we providing resources and utilities to these development. And then finally, I want to talk about evacuation routes. So we have a lot of communities that sit that may have one point in, one point out, and that can be really challenging for evacuation. So we need to think about evacuation planning, like fire sheds, like what happens if a fire is coming? How do we just get the community underground into a safe space, kind of like we do with tornadoes?
Wow.
So those are some development things that we can think about going forward.
Well, Erica Fisher, you have the last word here. There's literally 30 seconds left, but I just want to say there's policy change that can happen at the state level, right? I mean, that's going on in Oregon right now.
Yes. Oregon has adopted Senate Bill 762, and it's a very progressive wildfire policy that focuses on the communities. I think all these communities and states are really trying to take a step forward, and I'm hopeful for the future.
Okay. Well, you know what? This feels like the beginning of what needs to be an ongoing conversation. So Erica Fisher, Assistant Professor of Civil and Construction Engineering at Oregon State University, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Meghna.
And Natasha Stavros, Director of the Earth Lab Analytics Hub at the University of Colorado Boulder. Natasha, thank you so very much for being with us.
Thanks for starting this conversation.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.